I want to start off, though, with some words by a person called Joe Guy, who's from Palm Island, and he started with, "Nobody knows Uncle Willie, but he knows about you. We are like my Uncle Willie, but for our lives are like his. Let me tell you people, we are the ones living our lives under the thumb. We have got to fight for our rights every day, every night. Nobody knows Uncle Willie, but he knows about you. He's my father's brother, my Uncle Willie." Uncle Willie, Willie Thiday, was actually one of the leaders of the 1957 strike that occurred. And he was actually deported off that island as a result of that. And so I suppose that was a bit of a tribute to him and for what happened. And that's, you know, he's well known to this day in terms of the inspirational sort of actions that happened. In the 1950s, Palm Island had already been a long-serving, ultimate sort of punitive destination for troublemakers in the Indigenous population across Queensland. And in fact, it had a reputation of terror in black communities right across that state, you know, sort of like an Alcatraz, because of the function that it had played right through the 20th century, that in Queensland, the Indigenous populations, under an extremely racist act, the genocidal policies of the government, under the Aboriginal and Islander Act, in fact, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders across that state were rounded up onto reserves, forced out from their traditional lands into hideous reserves, a bit similar to what occurred in South Africa. I'm going to pass around a map that actually just shows some of the reserves that literally thousands of people were rounded on up into. For those that weren't put onto these reserves, most of those people were forced to be on the pastoral land, to be cattlemen and so forth, to actually be, to work long hours for no wages. So either if you're Indigenous in Queensland, you ended up on a reserve with no rights, or you ended up working under basically slave-like conditions. Palm Island, as I said, was one of the places where the worst of the worst were meant to be sent. I'm going to pass around a second map. And again, also, I think people want to note, this is a map and these arrows actually mean something. This is actually thousands of people being forced to move around enormous distances under the most repressive conditions. And this second map also shows the population movements of which Ruth's, her own life experience and so forth was affected. So this is ongoing today. So it just shows the forcible intervention that the state did to a whole population of people. And one of the reasons why Palm Island was picked in the first place was because of its absolute isolation, that there was always, always struggle that occurred against the Aboriginal and Islander Act. There was never, ever people being passive against it. And from a very early stage, Palm Island was a result, was the government was forced to set up Palm Island because of the ongoing resistance to the absolute genocidal policies that Indigenous people right across Australia have had to endure since British invasion. So we saw right through the 20s and 30s, literally Murray and Torres Strait Islanders like rounded up and taken in chains to Townsville, where they were thrown onto ships and taken across to Palm Island. And there was basically little chance of escape from Palm Island. But also, it was a real, it just played such a role of terror in terms of population, in terms of to the Indigenous population. It was actually seen as that punishment place right across Queensland. There's some quotes that I've got here, like one labourer said, you know, they only had to mention Palm Island and we were all quiet. You know, that in terms of what did he mean by all quiet, in terms of shutting up and just, you know, we can't actually try and fight for some wages and decent lives. Another person said, we would just take a flogging and that was it. So just getting beaten up and so forth. If we thought, well, you know, we had to try and fight back, well, actually, we'd probably end up on Palm Island. Even a school child talked about, well, we lived in terror of imprisonment on Palm Island. So there's a real sense that Palm Island was this embodiment of the worst of the worst, if it could get any worse than living on the reserves or working on cattle stations and so forth. To give you a sense of who was sent there, In 1923, a stockman, a guy called Elby Hippie, was actually removed. And the official reasons was that, you know, he used to terrorise women and, you know, he wanted a bit of the liquor and so forth. But actually the real reason, and it was never recorded, was that actually he organised a petition amongst Aboriginal workers seeking greater control over their wages through actually having access to bank accounts. There were other countless examples for why people were sent to the island, such as a guy called Frank from Queensland. The only thing that was recorded was that he was an agitator. But also it was revealed that it wasn't just the troublemakers that ended up on Palm Island, that in 1930 it was revealed in a bit of a scandal that the greedy pastoralists were actually bribing, paying Queensland cops nice sums of money to just round up Murray, any of them, and ship them off to Palm Island as part of clearing the land and opening it up for profit. And that's obviously so fundamental to the ongoing oppression today, which we can talk about later. But it was also, once upon Palm Island, just to give you a bit of a sense of what it was like, the violence, the humiliation, the flogging, the imprisonments, women constantly had their heads shaven and were flogged, and also there were people exiled to a neighbouring island where one could be on this island for weeks and weeks only on bread and water. As one elder described it in our own language, everything on Palm Island is the idea of the superintendent, the person that was in charge of Palm Island. We got to do everything what suit the superintendent, not us, and every super that go there got the law in his own mouth. If they say go to jail, you can't say what for, and you don't know when you come out. So before I quickly talk about the superintendent that had a reign of terror on Palm Island during the 1950s and hence obviously played a major part in why there was the strike that took place in 1957. To give you a sense of the kind of people that the Queensland government sent to control the island, the first superintendent went berserk on this island. He actually killed his own family, shooting all staff members and burnt the main settlement down in 1930. This is the kind of mad people that they would send off to try and rule over the indigenous population that made up Palm Island. So pretty full-on kind of characters that would have to do the dirty work that, let's face it, was completely unnatural to human nature for some of the things that indigenous people had to endure. The superintendent that reigned supreme on Palm Island, a guy called Roy Henry Bartlam, during the 1950s, which was the most repressive period of Palm Island, he got the name given by the residents of Palm, Tomato Face, in honour of his red complexion. But also, like, when Tomato Face would be coming towards the school, literally, the classroom would, like, be that the school students there would, like, just absolutely tremble in fear because of this man when he would approach their classrooms. In subsequent interviews, Palm Island elders, Bartlam was referred to as the Red Emperor, a version of Hitler, the commandant, a superintendent that would work us like slaves. He would treat you like a dog, an old bastard, a man with a heart of stone. And actually, this wasn't just rhetoric. This reflected the absolute reality of how Palm Islanders and people that ended up on Palm Island had to endure their lives. During his reign of terror, the indigenous population had to salute all whites when they walked past, in no matter what circumstances. You had to work without pay, you had to queue up for rations of flour, tea, sugar, and you would get some offcuts of meat that you wouldn't even feed your dog. And they were forced to parcel up the actual, you know, the decent portions of meat for the white families that were on that island. Permits were needed for traditional dancing, to go fishing, to hunt, just to see one's wife or husband. You couldn't actually, there were a whole series of laws that restricted you to do that. But of course, when they were visiting magistrates or other educated officials from the government and so forth who would want to go on a cruise maybe around the island, they would use children to actually anchor the ship and stay in the water, the shark-infested water, and so forth. It was absolutely brutal. It was basically a rigid apartheid system that existed in social relations. One resident said that you couldn't even stand up and talk to a white man or woman in the street. If you were seen doing this, you would be thrown off into the slammer for 2 weeks. That was it. That's what would happen. The police, just like recently, they still do it today. It was common for people just to be killed, and it was commonplace for police brutality on Palm in the 1950s. Horrendous injuries and scars. The police used to use like hard bloodwood batons. So, you know, this is pretty fucking, atrocious type of weapons that would be used on people. And let me just describe what the jail was like, which was just near this superintendent's quarters, I suppose. It was, and people would be sent there for offences such as, and this is me quoting here, being untidy, failing to have a haircut. Well, women were imprisoned for wearing shorts or having a dress above the knee. One time a group of people were actually arrested for laughing, and another man was locked up for 28 days for waving at his wife. So this gives you some sense of the absolute repression, the absolute racism that the Australian state would impose on Indigenous people. And this reign of terror was absolutely to do with the whole systematic need of the Australian state to repress a population. One elder recalled being confined for 6 weeks without coming out of one of these cells. These cells were 8 foot by 9 foot wide and could barely have 2 people in it, let alone the normal 5 people that were locked up in the cells at any given time on Palm Island in the 1950s. And there was one sanitary tin for each cell. And remember, for us Victorians, it's hot and sticky up there, that these 5 people would have to take turns at gasping through the small air to breathe the fresh tropical air. You know, like the rest of the time you would have squashed in and so forth. One staff member said it was basically like, well, he described it as like the Gestapo times. Like, this is a staff member describing it. So it was extremely repressive, this period. And before I pass it on to Ruth, who's going to start talking about the actual strike itself, the work regime was extremely repressive. Every morning, on the dot, there were morning parades of workers who had to answer to a roll call and salute the superintendent. It sounds really horrific. And if you were even 30 seconds late, you would be taken away to the slammer, to the cell which I described before, and imprisoned for at least 2 weeks. And the work did not exclude the elderly or the heavily pregnant either. And so, and if again, any resistance was met, you would end up in the jail, or you would end up with extra labour to carry through, or you would end up with no rations whatsoever. So that just gives you a bit of a sense, I suppose, of what Palm Island was like for the population, the Indigenous population on that island. But I want to pass it on to Ruth now, and everyone should give her a big welcome, who's going to actually be talking about Palm Island.
Okay, you have to forgive me. I'm a little nervous. I didn't realise it was going to be such a big crowd. But I'm Ruth. I'm a proud Indigenous woman, Torres Strait descent, but my great-grandmother was taken from Darnley Island with her brother when she was little, because she had an illegitimate Japanese pearl diver father, and they were taken by the Catholic Church up to Papua New Guinea and were raised on an island up there. So as a result, I have Indigenous descent from the Torres Strait Islands as well as Papua New Guinea. So That's my brief history. Pardon? Okay, sorry. Okay. And I'm going to speak to you about Willie Thiday, who wrote this book, and he was involved in the Palm Island strike, and he's also my husband of 10 years, grandfather. So I have a really close personal history with Palm Island and the strikes. And, so I suppose I'll start with that. So this book, I'm going to read Willie's story, but the book is written as he would speak in broken English. So I think it's important to tell the story in his words. So I'm going to read it as he would speak. Okay. My name is Willie Thiday. I was born on Darnley Island in 1913 on the 18th of December, educated at school on Darnley up until the fourth grade because that's all they would allow me. During one night when there was a big Native Island dance for Christmas, one boy, he make trouble and we all fall in. Trouble is with a young girl from a different island and the three of us get the blame, but really there was no trouble at all. One fellow, he put his arm around that girl and he kissed her. That's all. I'm so young that I can't speak English and the protector is a very rough man. He believed what the council tell him. The council never stick up for any young fellas. They always like to shove them in jail. So all right, the three of us, we go to jail and the next morning they pull us out and put us in court. Mr. Green, he say, you boys, you're going to go to Palm Island. We didn't know what to say. No matter if you plead not guilty, you're still guilty with him. So we land at Palm Island, close to the new year, December the 27th, 1932. We see many people there, about 1,500, and there's 25 police there ready to arrest us three. The superintendent is Mr. Delaney. Mr. Delaney asks us, "Yous mob know anyone here?" And we say, "Yeah, we know Mundy William, one of our countrymen, an old fella." He says, "Yes, well, he's got plenty of room, but really, he's got no room at all. His house is very small. He's only pleased to have his own countrymen there. Anyway, we stopped there for a while through the Christmas holidays." Palm Island was not much then, only half a dozen houses with iron on the tops. All the rest are grass houses. So after a few years, 3 years, I get married. My wife was only 16 and I was 23. In 1936, just after I got married, they decided to elect a council for the first council on Palm Island. I was elected. There is my name, Albie Kyle, Sid Serico, Fred Brackenridge, Percy Smallwood, George Ryan was our secretary. We get no wages for it. One day I tell the council, "I think it's a good idea if the government see if they can give us some wages. We work a long time just for tobacco and not good tobacco either." Mm-hmm. We say we'll try to get some kind of wages, something for the work we done. So we go and see Mr. Simple about the wages. Mr. Simple, he say, "Well, I don't know. You know, you boys been here in the settlement for a long time. I don't think that the government will give it to you. You got tucker, you got flour, you got rice, you got porridge, you got sugar, you got everything you need, just like wages." But anyway, we speak up for our wages. We got to see Mr. O'Leary, so we write him a letter, and he comes over to Palm. "Why you want wages for?" he say. "You work long time for tobacco. What you want wages for?" We say, "Well, we want money. We want to see what we're working for." He say, "Well, I'll give you 4 shillings a fortnight." Everything on Palm Island is the idea of the superintendent, and according to the superintendent, we are the last people on earth. When they want anything from us, they sing out, "Jack, Bill, Harry, come and get me them things. Get me the meat. Get me the flour. Get this, get that." And the moment you refuse, you go to jail for 21 days. The policemen on Palm Island should not be called policemen. They are only trackers from far away inland, not from our country, and they know nothing about our law, not a scrap. They've never been to school, and all they do is what the superintendent tell them. "Can you do this?" "Yes, boss." "Can you do that?" "Yes, boss." They never say no. Then when they come to try, then they come and try and stand over us by the power of the superintendent. We got to do everything what suit the superintendent. What he say is law, and the state government allow him to make them rules for us. We know it's wrong, but still, you can't say nothing, because the moment you say something, they throw you in jail. If they say you go to jail, you can't say what for, and you don't know when you're going to come out. I saw some boys, two or three of them, they spent 18 months in that jail. every white person who stop over there has got a yardman, and the poor yardman has to do everything that they tell him to do. Get our meat, get our rations. When the beef comes from town on the boat, all the whites get the first serve. They slice off all the good parts for themselves, and only the bones and a little bit of meat is left for all the rest of us people on the settlement. 1,500 people. Then we all line up at the window to go get our meat, one by one. Sometimes it's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night before we finish. And if you go home and speak up that you missed out, you just go to jail. Every time the white people come from Townsville, we got to cart their ports and bags up to the places, and when they're ready to go, we get their ports and bags and bring them back to the boat again. They're like kings. But I don't think a king even acts like that. One time I was a foreman on the milk. We go milking the cows, about 46 cows. When we milk them, they give the first milk to the white fellas. And for the rest of us, natives, for us blacks, you got to break it down with water. 3 gallons of milk, you put water in to bring it up to 4 or 5 gallons for the babies. I have to do that myself. Another time I made 7 big fish traps on Palm Island. It was hard work. You got to go up to the hills, cut 50 sticks, about 14 or 15 feet long. I made 7 fish traps and out of all them sticks. Then you got to bring them way over and catch the tide. We caught a lot of fish that way. One day I caught a big groper and it weighed nearly 800 pounds. Mr. Croker, he say, come in and we'll take a photo of the groper and send it down to Brisbane for the annual report. But the next morning, when I go into the settlement to take the photo, I find out that Mr. Bartlam is going to be in the photo, and he will say that he caught the fish, but he never did nothing. Everything I do, they get the credit for. The farming jobs, the vegetables, bananas, lettuce, cabbage, cucumber, radish, carrot, I planted all of them. But when they're unloaded at the shop, they come there like they're the ones that have been working hard. They get their wages for nothing. I planted 600 coconut trees, yet I never tasted one coconut or got any credit for it. I put a new road in for the banana farm on top of the hill towards Mount Lindsay so the trucks can go up there and get the bananas. We made it with mattocks and picks and shovels. Mr. Taylor, who was there, didn't know how the hell we did it without a bulldozer. They treat us like dogs on Palm. The trouble really started on Palm when Mr. Croker interfered with the hygiene gang. The hygiene gang is run by Albie Geyer, and he's got his experience from Mr. Garrett, who shows him how to run it. Mr. Croker come from the bush somewhere and start to tell him what to do. They don't pay Albie anything or ever the right wages, and so he tells them they can stick their money. But Mr. Bartlam doesn't want to say that to Mr. Croker because that's his brother-in-law. One night I see Sonny Sibley, Freddie Clay, George Watson, Billy Congu, Eric Limburner and Albie Geyer talking in the street, and I don't know what for. They say, come over here, listen, we think we're going to make a strike. And I say, what for are you going to make a strike? And they say, we see if we're going to strike against Mr. Bartlam. I don't know anything about the trouble because I'm running the banana farm. Anyway, I go with them because I'm full up with Mr. Bartlam. Any small thing that you do wrong, he cut your wages. He's never satisfied. I only get 10 shillings a week, yet he cut my wages. No wages for a month, but Mr. Bartlam always makes sure he gets his full wages every fortnight. He don't care about anyone else. They can starve so long as they work for him and Mr. Croker. Mr. Bartlam also treats our women really badly. I saw with my own eyes the women who refuse to go and scrub the hospital and the white women's houses. They shove them in jail. The women can't do it because they got to look after their own little people in their own home, but he won't have it. They still got to do what he wants. One time I go to the settlement and they tell me to escort a girl from jail to sweep the office and the street. They put her in jail because she ran away from the dormitory one night. They put her in a bag dress and shaved her head. This is an ordinary sack with the corners cut off, all by Mr. Bartlam's instruction. So Early in the morning, about 4 o'clock, they strike my place. Detective Sergeant Cronin, Inspector Crook, and Greg Barry, Senior Sergeant of Police. Mr. Cronin say, "Don't move, Willie, or you're gonna get hurt." I say, "What for?" "You come under arrest." Soon as I come out the door, they catch me. They shove me and make me go forward. Detective Cronin says, "Don't try and do any dirty tricks or you'll get hurt." They slam handcuffs on my hands and we come down to the beach. There's another 5 coming too, and we all seem to reach the boat together. Albie Geyer, Billy Congu, Sonny Sibley, George Watson, Eric Limburner, and Gordon Tupper. Anyway, we walk down the beach and get into a boat, a flatty. We start to argue. Then we say, "Greg Barry, you're not a fair man. Someday this thing gonna go fly back at you." Soon we all pull out a bit, and I strike out into a big island song about our home. The captain fellow called Mr. Whiting, and he hear us say, "Who are those boys? They can't be going to prison in handcuffs. They seem so happy. They're singing." And we sing like anything in the military patrol boat. It belongs to the Air Force in Townsville. The policemen are on top, and a machine gun is pointed down at us. When we get on the boat, it is nearly daylight. The walkie-talkie is going all the time, talking to people on shore, talking to people in Townsville. They ask him, "How are them boys?" They say, "Nothing wrong. They're singing like hell. Mr. Whiting just can't get over it." They wait to arrest us. They think we're all wild fellas on a boat, but really we're happy fellas. When 8 o'clock came, Inspector Cook and Detective Sergeant Cronin asked my wife, "You want to go with him too?" She say, "Oh yes, I like to go." "Well, roll up your swag, take what you can, sit in the same boat with Willie." So women and family come in the same boat. They send the other people after. I got one child about 4 months old and one grandson. I look from the boat and see them walking on the jetty. I think, all my family coming with me, that's all right. We're still in the boat, singing like anything. I feel happy. I don't care about my belongings because everything is lost. Somebody can pick them up later. I got no chance to claim them. The sea was very rough, 30 or 40 knot winds. I tell the policeman, "You better take my handcuffs off because them kids might fall overboard. I got to watch them." He's a good sergeant too, and he takes the handcuffs off. I hold my little daughter and the others, Nina, Dulcie, Tele, David, all the little ones, all squashed up. I sit on the stern and get wet all the way from there to Townsville. The others, Albie and them inside, got handcuffs with the policeman guarding them. All of them have guns at their side, just like we did a big murder or something. We come to Townsville, to the Air Force Wharf, and we get off. The police car's ready there too. We stop there now and wait for a removal order from Mr. O'Leary. 4 days later, the removal order comes. Willie Thiday, Albie Geyer, Sonny Sibley, you go to Woorabinda. Billy Corgi, George Watson, Eric Limburn, you go to Cherbourg. Gordon Tapau, you go to Bamaga. When we leave Woorabinda, it is as cold as anything, and we got no warm clothes, we got nothing. I come away with only one shirt. We go a day and a night to Rocky. They take me to jail in Rockhampton and lock me up, my wife too, and all the family was locked up too. Then they take me to Woorabinda that same night. We get to 40 miles from Woorabinda and we catch a car that take us to Woorabinda. The sergeant who escorted us from Palm Island is still with us. He comes in too. Mr. Bailey is the driver and 2 native police from Woorabinda. It's a really bad drive. We're jammed up like fish in a tin. You got to sit like that all the way and they put handcuffs on us too. We come to Woorabinda boundary and Mr. Bailey says, "Well, if you boys want to run away, you can try run away now, but you got nowhere to go." He's just talking smart. We get to Woorabinda but got no home to sleep in. So they take me to the single men's home. Me and my family was jammed up in one corner of a single men's home. I say, "No matter, we just put up with it. Them other blokes are all right here. They don't come with their families. We'll be all right." Next morning we get up and Mr. Nags, the superintendent of Woorabinda, come in and say, "Well, Willie, there is one old broken home there. You got to find it the best way you can and make it good. we won't give you a truck to get timber, but we'll give you mattresses for you. But you got to take the timber on your shoulders. I see the house. It's got a bark roof, a bark wall, and I say, that's no good to me. It's too dirty. It's stinking, proper filthy. I don't care if I have to go to jail. I will refuse that house. I go and tell Mr. Nags. Before I left Palm Island, they have a show and I win the prize in a competition for a good home. I got a good home, a good yard, first class everything. I leave a good home on Palm Island. I never do bad on Palm Island. We had an argument there with the superintendent for his wrongdoing. He treat you like a dog on Palm, but that's why I come here. Anyway, Mr. Shepherd say, you got to go in the house. And I say, no, I won't go in there and you can do what you like with me. I won't take my family to sleep there. I will stay at the boys' home. He says, please yourself. So we bring the mattresses down 500, 600, 700 yards. I lump them all on my shoulder, one at a time. I got no relations there, you see. I know a lot of people, but no relations who can call me into their home. We got no saucepan, no plate, no spoon, no nothing, and there are 10 in my family. We live that way, eating very little tucker, cooking little. We only borrow saucepan, borrow plate, borrow spoon, and you have to go to work the next morning. If you don't work, you go to jail. One morning, the superintendent called me into the office. Now, you can go out if you like. I can give you £10 and you can go and look for a job. Well, I can't go. I got all my family there and I'm trying to set up a home. I say to Albie, you go first. I'll stop here and I'll make it good for our families. I'll go afterwards. So I stop and settle down. We stayed in the single men home, but all kind of things happened there, swearing, drinking and so on. Some old people belong to my wife's mob come and tell me, you come over to our house. That house you got is not much good. That is a house for single men. So we go and stop with them for a few months, I think. I tell the wife, I must go and try work. So I see Mr. Nags and he puts me on a farm where I work for nothing but a piece of tobacco. I say to Mr. Nags, I got to go look for a job. I just wanted to end with this one quote that Willie made. They treat us like dogs on Palm. To them, we're only animals. But we're human, the same as them. And we got feelings, the same as them. Only trouble is, we are coloured. Sometimes I sit down and think, for 200 years they treat us like that. All our land they take away. While we are patiently waiting for them to give it back, they still look down on us. Why do they do that? They are educated. They know good from bad. Good from bad. They send priests and pastors to our island, preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ every Sunday. They rest on the pulpit on Palm and preach the gospel to us. Thou shalt not kill. You must love one another, not hate one another, not get hatred in your heart. Why they got to preach to us and we abide by them things? And when the priest turn his back, different whites come in and say, you can hate one another because they got hatred themselves. Against us. I think it's my turn now to talk. All I can do is write it in a book. I not say anything lie about them things because all this thing is what happened on Palm Island.
I'm just going to say a couple of things about this slide and then we can do it. Is that okay? Can we do
that? So they were the direct words of one of the strike leaders. I just wanted to fill some of more information about the actual strike itself. It lasted for 5 days. So it lasted for 5 days, the strike. It started, as Willie said, because one of the key people on the island, a guy called Elby Guy, got... stood up for himself and so forth, and it sued, and he refused to actually get arrested and get deported, and didn't take long for the Palm Island community to actually rally behind him when he fought off the police and so forth. But it went from a spontaneous action to an actually organised strike. That there was a meeting that happened on that first day where they actually agreed to stop all building work, stop delivering all goods across the island except to the hospital. So there was a certain level from spontaneity to organisation that I hope the history that that Ruth's read out today and shared, and what I've said said before, you could see how people's material conditions and so forth meant that they were forced to and did organise and struggle. And it was quite amazing over those 5 days, because some of the deliveries still arrived on Palm Island, how the strikers, the community, actually reorganised the island, that the food that got delivered, instead of the meat getting carved up and given to the whites, they distributed amongst themselves, and the whites got nothing, which is, you know, really inspiring to see that. And that for the first time, the state lost control of the island. They couldn't control it anymore through the terror, through the exploitation, through all the might that they'd used, including the division that that Willie talked about, because Palm Island was made up of people right across Queensland. They used that division to try and stop any successful action from happening. And I think it's really important here to see how united action through everyone having to labour together and so forth, and it's basically they were part of the working class, that solidarity meant that they could actually, for the first time, use that real power, that collective strength, to actually stand up to the state and give a glimmer of hope. And at that time as well, there was a number of increased activity and solidarity and links, not just on Palm Island, but with the Indigenous struggle, with left-wing movements, with trade unions and so forth, of which some people on the island had some connection with. And that played a really important role as well in terms of those 5 days of action. Unfortunately, as we heard, the police did get the strike leaders and round them up at gunpoint in the middle of the night and get them off the island. And subsequently, another 200 people got deported from Palm Island, troublemakers and so forth, to try and calm the situation down. And the strike ended only because the state stopped all food and rations and supplies arriving. So effectively, the strike came to an end because they were starved out. They had no choice but to return to work. But as I said, there was a lot of lessons learnt, and we've seen right up until recent history that struggle continues today in Aboriginal communities, Indigenous communities across Australia, and indeed on Palm Island. And I want to move on to now, Ruth's going to be talking about her cousin, Murungi, actually got killed by cops in 2002. And Ruth was involved and around, directly involved in that, and she wants to actually share some of that issues about what happened from a, you know, personal point of view, I suppose, which is such an important history for us to hear, because this strike and this hidden history that, of course, the ruling class want to bury, the Australian state wants to bury, actually continues on today. And so I'm going to pass it back on to Ruth to talk about more recent events of what's going on more generally. I just want to also pass around, it's quite amusing the way the media reported the Palm Island strike and so forth. It's pretty predictable, all the racism and so forth. So there's just a few of the headlines that were put out at the time. I'm also going to pass around the book that Ruth just read from. People want to flick through quickly. There's photos, pictures. Also, there's the act that they had to live under that's printed in there, which amounts to, you'd treat your dog better than the way that this act was put onto people.
Okay, so I just wanted to talk about my personal experience of what happened when Murungi died. To me, he's Cameron, and so I'll refer to him as Cameron while I'm speaking. Cameron died There was a family feast on Palm Island tombstone opening, which is a celebration when somebody dies, depending on where they are in your community, if they're an elder or not, there's a certain amount of grieving period. So we were having a tombstone opening, which was being celebrated. And on his way home from that, Cameron was picked up by the police and arrested at 11 o'clock in the morning. And I think it was by 20 past 11 on the coroner's report was when he was dead. So within 20 minutes of being in custody, he had died. But what led up to the riots was the family weren't informed of Cameron being dead. His wife went to the police station at 1 o'clock and said, "Oh, you know, what's going on? You've arrested Cameron." And they said, "Oh, look, he's drunk. He's got to sober up. So come back later." She then went back again at 3 o'clock and they said, "No, he's still sleeping it off. You know, come back." So she went back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and they said, "All right, he's dead." So it was a big shock to all of the family. But then what happened after that? The family were asking why, how did he die, what happened? And from that Friday afternoon until the following Tuesday, each day the police gave a different reason for why Cameron died. One was that he got pinned in between the paddy wagon somehow. Another was that he fell on some steps and cracked his ribs. And so by the following Tuesday, the family had just had enough. And they weren't treated in any kind of respectable or dignified manner. And so as a result, Cameron's friends, and he had a young son that was 16 at the time, and his friends just got sick of it and went down to the police station, the place where Cameron died, and just vented their anger. And Palm Island's a very, very small community, so everybody came out to see what was going on. It wasn't a 200-strong riot that was reported in the media. It was his closest friends and his son and his friends just grieving in the only way that they knew possible. And that's where a lot of the charges for the people who are currently in trouble for rioting, that's what they're being charged with, for burning down the police station and that sort of stuff. So I arrived on Palm Island a couple of weeks before Cameron's funeral, and we got there and there were federal police everywhere at the schools in particular. My daughter was 4 at the time and was terrified of them because they had these big machine guns and SWAT outfit, and in the papers and the news it was pretty much, oh, they're peacekeepers, they're here to make everybody feel safe, but everyone was terrified of them. I took my camera and went over to the burnt-out police station and wanted to take pictures of it, and one of the police officers came over to me, snatched my camera, and I just quick thinking, I didn't really know what to say, and he asked me to delete my photos, and I said no. He got a little bit cranky with me, and I lied and said, "Well, I work for the New York Times, so you better give me my camera back." Yeah, so I got my camera back, minus 2 deleted photos. But, the police presence was there for a really, really long time. And then it took 3 weeks for us to get Cameron's body back. And in that time, we didn't know if the coroner in Brisbane, Cairns or Townsville had his body. It was like just trying to get blood out of a stone, trying to get information out of the government departments that we were dealing with. So it was a cover-up pretty much. Everything was pretty much everywhere you turn, there was some kind of bureaucratic red tape going on. When we did get Cameron's body back, he was so battered and bruised that we couldn't recognise him. It was really, really quite unnerving. But I think it's important to know, because a lot of people think, oh, you know, this is just made up. But I saw him and I saw what they did to him, and it wasn't very pleasant. So yeah, it still goes on today, and it's really important, I think, that people know about it.